Authentic Wellness Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome to episode number 52 of Authentic Wellness Radio, and today's episode is going to be a really, really good one. I'm joined by someone very special who's done something very special. Her name's Dr. Kelly Brogan. She is a psychiatrist with a degree in cognitive neuroscience from MIT. She got her MD from Weill Cornell Medical College. She got her clinical training from the New York University School of Medicine. She's published articles in many journals and medical publications, including Alternative and Complementary Therapies, The Carlet Report, Journal of American Medical Association, Price-Pottinger Journal, and I really could go on for the entire show and read out her qualifications, but I won't. She's the author of a book that I've been reading all week, which is absolutely brilliant. It's called The Truth About Depression. Oh, sorry. It's called A Mind of Your Own, The Truth About Depression and How Women Can Heal Their Bodies to Reclaim Their Lives. Dr. Kelly Brogan, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. I just like took a nap during that entire introduction. Oh my God, my bio. So boring.
I could have gone on for a lot longer. I was on your website looking and I was like, wow, how did she get time to write a book?
I'm what could be described as a workaholic for sure.
Yeah. Now, you're a psychiatrist. So you were trained in medical school to think that antidepressants were to the depressed like eyeglasses are to the short-sighted, you said in your book. So do you want to talk briefly about your origins?
Yeah. So I did not grow up in any sort of new age or hippie family. I come from Italian Irish stock and my parents very much, defer to the doctor and always have and still do actually. And, so I went to, college at MIT and there I worked a suicide hotline actually. And it was supervised by a psychiatrist. I was studying neuroscience and sort of together this illusion was created that for me that we had sort of cracked the code on human behavior. And so I was very interested in going to medical school to become a psychiatrist and to sort of, you know, help people with their suffering, right? Sounds like a grand idea. And it really wasn't until I was in my fellowship, right? I was specializing in medicating, because that's what psychiatrists do for the most part, medicating pregnant and postpartum women. And I was pregnant at the time. And I remember having this sort of feeling, right, that I would never take one of these medications and as a pregnant woman. And that's pretty dissonant, right, because I'm writing these prescriptions every single day. And it wasn't until I sort of ignored it. And it wasn't until about 9 months postpartum when I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis that same voice sort of cropped up again. And I had this feeling like, this sucks. I don't want to take a prescription, you know, for the rest of my life. Like there's gotta be a way out of this. And so I guess I had the intuitive hit to see a naturopath. It was very weird for me to do something like that because I was very much somebody who believed that, you know, perfect health was just one prescription away at any given time for everyone else, apparently, but me. And so I engaged in some lifestyle changed my diet, simple stuff, took out gluten, dairy, and sugar. And within 6 months, my antibodies went from the high 2000s to normal range. And not only that, but I felt like a completely different person in ways I didn't even know were not part of my personality, you know, like irritability and fatigue and palpitations I just always had. And I think I probably like spent like my entire adult life like pooping once a week. Like I thought that was normal. So there were a lot of changes that happened in a really short time. And it raised a red flag for me because I realized that I hadn't learned about this in medical school, that you could put Hashimoto's or an autoimmune disease into remission. That's not something we learn anything about. And we certainly don't learn anything about the role of nutrition in that or any process really. So that was sort of the beginning of the opening of Pandora's box for me, which, you know, continues to this day where I spend a lot of time in the primary literature trying to understand sides of science that are not presented to us by mainstream mouthpieces.
The thing that came to mind most when I was reading through the start of your book was that you're a natural skeptic, not a cynic, but a skeptic, which I really liked. So your book really delves quite a lot into the corruption of modern psychiatry, and you talk a lot about antidepressants, and you say 30 million people in the US alone are using antidepressants, and presumably those people all have families and jobs and relationships, so it's affecting a lot more people than just them. But to start out the show, I thought we'd dive into some shock and awe statistics that came up in your book, which I was reading thinking, wow, this is unbelievable. So if it's all right with you, Dr. Brogan, can we run through a few quick true or falses out of your book?
Let's do it.
All right. So you were a practicing psychiatrist, and in all the time that you were doing that, prescribing antidepressants, you never once cured a patient.
True. Absolutely true.
Right. So 5 of the top 10 most violence-inducing drugs in the world have been found to be antidepressants.
True.
In its first 12 years of use, Prozac had 40,000 reports of adverse effects submitted to the FDA.
Mm-hmm. Most ever reported. True.
Did they get rid of it or go back and change it or something like that?
Prozac, you can just head over to your family practice doctor and get yourself a prescription today.
Well, not in Australia, you can't. We have something different, but I'm sure it's pretty much the same with a different name here.
I'm sure it's the same, yeah, with a different name, exactly.
Now, here's a big one. When hepatitis C patients are treated with the pro-inflammatory drug interferon, almost half of them get major depression as a result.
Yes, this was a big sort of learning point around the inflammatory model of depression, which is something I'm pretty interested in. Exactly.
Okay. Now, onto the effectiveness of antidepressants. So you quote a man called Dr. Kirsch in your book. I didn't catch his first name, but...
Irving.
Irving Kirsch. What a great name that is.
Right? Exactly.
So he used the Freedom of Information Act to leverage access to unpublished studies on antidepressants. So these are studies that were done, designed, and run by drug companies themselves and then put in a drawer for some reason. And he found that when you include those studies that these pharmaceutical companies decided never to talk about, antidepressants lost to placebos in 26 out of 46 studies. So they're less reliable than lying to someone and saying, hey, here's something that's going to work in it. It actually is nothing. Is that true or false?
Yes. What he found was that what we are calling antidepressant effect is actually what he calls, and he coined, the active placebo effect, which is something super interesting we can certainly talk about. But that was a real shocker for me because I had so many patients, you know, and of course, every time I lecture, I have somebody stand up who says, well, Prozac saved my life or Zoloft saved my life. What are you talking about that it doesn't work? It's all in my head. And in fact, you know, there are a number of like totally fascinating studies that really prove that this is absolutely what's going on. It's pretty crazy. Yeah.
So do you consider depression to be a disease then?
No, I thought it was a nice idea, you know, in my training that depression or bipolar or even schizophrenia were discrete disease entities, even though we don't do any physical testing. There's no brain scan, no blood work, no EEG. Nothing to diagnose it. It's just a conversation, right? It's sometimes a very short conversation. I really wanted to believe that it was like an actual thing. But of course, what we're now learning is that it's really just a symptom. It's a descriptive term for a symptom, the same way that a fever is a symptom. It doesn't tell you what's causing it. Many, many different things can cause what we're calling depression. And it certainly doesn't tell you that there is one fix for it, no matter what's causing it.
All right. Now, last true or false question. It's pretty unlikely that we'll ever see Dr. Kelly Brogan talking about the kind of stuff that you're going to share with us today on a network TV channel or on a big news channel, because direct-to-consumer advertising for antidepressants is a $4.8 billion industry, and anyone running negative stories about these drugs like you do on their network will lose tens of millions of dollars in ad revenue.
Yeah, this is true. I warned my publishers about this. It's like, I guess this is their first rodeo, you know, dealing with somebody speaking out against industry. But, you know, it's already been the case that we got the galleys, you know, the sort of pre-order copies of this book to every network in New York City. And we got one no after another no after another no. And then we actually got a threat that if they were to have me on, that it would actually be negative press for me. So this is actually unprecedented for my publisher, Harper, and I am not surprised a bit.
So I think it's very important for everyone who's listening to this, if you can share this message, whether it's this show or someone else's, help Kelly Brogan in her cause here, because this is a big deal. Now, I want to start out by talking about you as a researcher. So I was reading your book and I bought it on my iPad. because we only teed up this interview a couple of days ago. And when I read on my iPad, I flip it sideways and it said 1,100 pages. And I thought, oh, this is a big book. And then I got to page 500 or something, which doesn't mean there's 500 pages in the book. That's just how it showed up on my iPad. And then most of the back was resources and references of the study that you've done. So you talk a lot in the book about research being bought and paid for and manipulation of results and wrangling for various reasons designed to help the antidepressant drug cause. Now, how do we know that when you say that that research isn't reliable and the stuff in the back of your book is, that we should trust you and that you are reliable?
That's a great question. You know, one of the major skills that I taught myself after I began this sort of investigation was to understand the nature of a study, right? And some of the most important questions you can ask when you're looking at a study is who, you know, performed the study and who pays them, right? It certainly is not always the case that a study is useless just because, you know, industry, whether it's agricultural industry, the food industry, or pharmaceutical companies are paying for it. But it should actually, you know, raise a degree of skepticism around, you know, what it is that you're reading and the quality of the research, because, of course, you know, there are profit-bearing interests in the outcomes. That's natural. It's just human nature to, you know, to engage in this kind of bias when you're publishing research that you're very vested in, right? So knowing who's performing the research is pretty critical. And unfortunately, you know, our system in America is such that the FDA really only requires two studies for the licensure of a new medication. And those studies are provided almost uniformly by the very company that is going to profit from the licensure of that medication. And what's amazing is that a pharmaceutical company can essentially perform as many studies as they want until they get those two positive results. So it's sort of like flipping a coin until you get heads and then saying that you got heads on the first try. And then they can, you know, really put in a locked file drawer whichever ones don't serve them. So the research that I, you know, am very interested in is independent research. It's hard to come by. And you know, it doesn't mean that it's all excellent quality, but most of the time I am using science to confirm and support what we already know intuitively about the simplicity of human health, about getting back to basics and about undoing what we have, you know, what damage we have wrought over the past 100 to 150 years since the Industrial Revolution, getting back to a place of more natural exposures. So the science is essentially almost common sense in this regard.
Now, you say that the way that studies can be run can also be manipulative too. And one instance you gave was that a group of people with depression were all put on a placebo and they're told, hey, you're going to take this placebo for the next month. And then half of you are going to be swapped over to an antidepressant. So the researchers in that instance are creating a positive expectancy there, which kind of boosts the placebo effect because everyone's expecting themselves to get better, even though some of them might not. Is that one of the examples of what you're talking about?
Yeah. So the placebo research, in fact, I'm just about to drop another blog on this because there's a new study out looking at, and then I'll just get back to your question, but looking at how we are beginning to understand that people who respond to placebos favorably also respond to antidepressants more, you know, more notably, and they seem to have more activity in an area and of the brain that is related to the reward system, and specifically opiate receptors. So the same receptors that have, you know, that receive morphine, for example. So we are sort of wired to engage in the ritual of pill popping, you know, with a set of beliefs. And it's never more relevant than, as far as I can tell, than in the field of psychiatry, although it is relevant across medicine. In fact, there are a number of even sham surgery, you know, studies that are being done to demonstrate how much belief in a surgery's potential to cure actually influences the outcomes. So this is an extremely powerful effect. In fact, arguably, it's the most powerful effect. It's more effective than anything that a medication can do, because there's an amazing study that's actually something of the opposite of what you've described, where patients are on Prozac, right, and they feel that Prozac has done them right. They're feeling good. Their symptoms are in remission. And they're told that they're either going to continue their same dose of Prozac, you know, the one that helped them, or they're going to be randomized to a sugar pill. And just the mere prospect of being randomized to a sugar pill or placebo actually resulted in both of the groups becoming depressed, right? So you're still taking your same very effective dose of Prozac, but then you actually develop depression despite that. And that's the power of expectancy in psychiatry. And you know, what Irving Kirsch, you know, essentially revealed was that this is called the active placebo effect, when the side effects of medication — and antidepressants have tons of side effects, right? Including some very rapid onset ones like dry mouth or headache or gastrointestinal upset. So when you start to experience those and you're in a trial, what happens? You tell yourself, oh my God, I'm in the treatment group. That means I'm going to be getting better. And this whole cascade of healing biochemistry is set off by that simple belief, right? So he actually argues and shows evidence for the fact that when you have a trial with an active medication like an antidepressant, and you compare it to a medication like, for example, atropine, that has very similar side effects, there's no difference at all. And that's how he came up with this concept of the active placebo effect and proved it, I think, rather rigorously in his statistical analysis.
Fascinating, amazing stuff. Now let's talk about you as what you do with patients. So based on what I read in your book, it sounds like you're a really excellent holistic health practitioner. And I've been around some really, really good ones and I can tell that you're well-versed in that. So I really enjoyed reading about a patient experience and what happens when someone first comes to see you. So we all know how it works when you go to the doctor. You're in there, you've got 15 minutes with them. You say, well, here's what's going on. And then they pull out a piece of paper and say, we're going to take this, and then I'll check up on you later. What happens when you see a patient for the first time?
So, you know, I have to give credit where credit is due. And in my fellowship, in my conventional training, I actually began to learn the art of getting to know your patients and the importance of having a more thorough conversation about medication with them. And this is when I was prescribing to pregnant women. So even back then, even when I was practicing conventionally, I always had much longer consultation appointments. That being said, now a big part of what I'm doing when I'm meeting with a patient is essentially getting a bird's eye view of their entire life so that I can begin to understand some of the milestones that have contributed to how their immune system, for example, how their hormonal system, and how their nervous system is functioning at this stage in their adult life, right? It started way back when, how they were born, whether they were breastfed or formula fed, whether they were fully vaccinated, if they took antibiotics, you know, every month for tonsillitis, whether they took birth control when they were a teenager, you know, what happened, you know, when they lost their first job or broke up with a boyfriend, how did they deal with that type of stress? And so all of these pieces are very relevant, but a very subtle pulse that I have to take is actually around their belief, you know, and their mindset, their beliefs around health and healing for the reasons that we just talked about, right? Because I am not interested in coercing patients to do anything that doesn't feel native to them. I'm interested in joining them on a journey, essentially, and escorting them across the threshold and then, you know, setting them off on their own. So, you know, my consultation is 2 hours when we first meet, and I often go over, and then we run some basic lab work. I assign them their first month of lifestyle change, which is primarily dietary change, and they don't get a second appointment until they've done that.
Can I just say, I really like the idea of doing that.
Yeah, it works. It works because it's accountability. You know, some people need a trainer at the gym. Some people need, you know, their spouse to be wagging a finger at them, you know, to do the dishes when they're sitting there. It's just accountability. And we're sort of, many of us, wired for it. You know, self-initiation is very challenging, and there's not many of us who are sort of configured that way. So it does work. But it's it's a rapid process, because once I work with someone who we have that kind of alchemy, you know, in terms of belief systems, it's like, you know, gangbusters. It just gets going and changes happen really quickly.
Mm. Now, you said in your book, my new knowledge of the body, that's how you got when you started studying holistic health, completely upended almost everything I'd learned during my long medical training spanning more than a decade. I was forced to unlearn most of what had cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars, sleepless nights, undue stress, and indentured servitude. Was that a scary thing for you to do, to just turn your back on all that?
Mm. So I've always been a really righteous person and a very, you know, like I've got a big mouth and I've always been very opinionated. So for me, I have, you know, again, it's like that skeptical mind. So once I sort of began to see that there was something fishy going on here, it's like I probably spent years obsessively, like every weekend, every night, every spare moment, I was reading, picking brains of people who had, you know, tread this path before me. And I wanted to get to the bottom of how I could have possibly been duped to this extent. And essentially, I left no stone unturned, right? So I, you know, whether it was obstetrics, whether it was cardiology or infectious disease and psychiatry, I looked at all of the most commonly prescribed medications, and I wanted to know what the real deal was in terms of how safe are these medications? Do they work in the way that we think they do? Or are we using old science to justify, you know, dangerous interventions?
Now let's talk about number to treat for these antidepressants. I was watching someone on a TEDx talk the other day, and he was talking about statins. And I think he said that for every 300 people who take statins, one of them is actually cured and their blood cholesterol lowers down and they don't need to take the drug anymore. So for them, the number to treat is 300 people to get one one treatment, I guess you could say. And he said this, that 5% of people will suffer side effects. So for every 300 people who get treated by a statin, one person gets healed, 15 people get side effects. What are the numbers like around antidepressants for number to treat?
You know, according to the literature, there's something between like 5 and 7, but it's a totally different deal, right? Like we use these surveys. It's essentially practically something you could get out of like Cosmo magazine. This is literally the science of psychiatry. It's a survey. Sometimes we use something called the MADRS, sometimes called the HAM-D, and it's a questionnaire. That's how we're determining the efficacy of these medications. And, you know, again, when Irving Kirsch did that research, he looked at all of these studies that used something called the HAM-D, and he found that there was a difference of like 1 or 2 points out of 52 points between placebo and the active medication. That difference could literally be accounted for by like a little bit of like a sedative side effect. You know, it's like a minor, minor change. We're not talking about like a life-altering experience here, and we're calling that efficacy. It's not. So we have to acknowledge that this is fundamentally a different realm of medicine than any other specialty that uses metrics, biometrics like, you know, cholesterol, even if I would argue they're grossly misunderstood, at least they're using uniform metrics for their statistics.
Mm, absolutely. Now, let's go on to some of the causes that you identified potentially for depression in your book. So inflammation is one. In fact, you say that curcumin, which is the part of turmeric that makes it gold, is in fact more effective for treating depression than Prozac even, because it's anti-inflammatory. And you mentioned that the brain actually doesn't have any receptors in there that tell us when it's actually in pain. So if you were to do surgery on, well, we've all seen TV shows, mm-hmm, where, you know, patients are in a chair and a doctor's, you know, drilling into their brain and someone's holding up a card in front of them and they're not in pain. So when it comes to inflammation, if that happens in other areas of the body, like let's say someone sprains their ankle, they feel pain and they get messages from the body that's like, hey, something's not right here. Don't keep using this. So it'll swell up. They won't be able to stand on it. It'll go red. It'll heat up. Now, is inflammation happening around the body the same message, but just with a different symptom to a sprained ankle from the body telling us stop, rest, allow this thing to heal?
That's exactly it, right? So inflammation at the brain level is quote unquote silent, right? Believe it or not, there are other sort of areas of the body where it can also be silent, including in your gut. So we're basically learning that, you know, we've evolved over 2.5 million years to expect certain exposures. And over the past 100 years, especially, we've changed the game, right? So we're exposed to over 100,000 unstudied toxicants in our environment. Thanks to, you know, the chemical and agricultural industry, we are, you know, experiencing all sorts of strange and sustained kinds of stress. We're not sleeping. We're not exposing ourselves to sunlight. We're not moving the way that we, you know, used to for all of those millions of years. And we are certainly not consuming anything that resembles the food that we have grown over time to subsist on, right? So in this setting, we have developed what are called the diseases of modern civilization, right? Cancer, autoimmunity, diabetes, heart disease, all of these chronic and degenerative illnesses have been traced back to inflammatory signaling, right? And it's not that the body is making a mistake. I always sort of hate that when there's like sort of refers to as the body like sort of like messing up and signaling in all these like inflammatory ways. It's actually doing that for a purpose because ancestrally, inflammation was a way to actually induce behaviors very consistent with depression, right? So depression is what we call comorbid. It coexists with all of those illnesses I just mentioned. And it's actually a way to slow you down, remove you from a social, you know, milieu, and to have you allow yourself the space and time to recover. That's what it used to do before it was such a chronic type of triggering, you know, that we see today. So the inflammatory messages can come from many different sources, right? They can come from toxicant exposures. They can come from psychosocial stress. And most notably, they can come from the gut. That's probably our best researched, source, right? So it can come from something that you're eating, that you're not digesting, something that you're exposed to that is causing local inflammation at the gut, that's interfering with the integrity of the gut lining, and that's then sending signals and stimulating the immune system that are trafficking to the brain. We used to think, even when I was in medical school, that there was no immune system in the brain, literally. And so now we know there is, and we know that it's largely responsible for what we are seeing is highly, highly correlated with states of depression. And by the way, other quote unquote mental illnesses like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia.
There's so many things about the body that we don't know. In fact, in your book, you mentioned that there's lymphatic vessels in the brain that we only have just recently found.
Last year.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Fascinating. And
basic anatomy. We're still discovering basic anatomy.
Yeah, I heard the name of another one. For me, I'm a student of physical therapy, so I feel like I should know the anatomy of the muscular system pretty well. And someone told me about a ligament that I'd never heard of that apparently was recently discovered called the Hay-Allen-Burns ligament. And I thought, wow, what a cool name that is.
That's amazing. I mean, you got to remain humble.
Exactly. So let's talk about this gut health and how it links to inflammation. So you talk about a lot, but one thing that I found really fascinating was the conversation about lipopolysaccharides. So for everyone listening, lipo, fat, poly, lots of saccharides, sugars. So it's fat and some sugars, basically. And these are meant to be in the body in certain places. And if they get into other places, it's like instant inflammation, like that's a switch. Right. So what are they supposed to do and what are they not supposed to do?
Yes, that's right. So basically, this is a natural component of gram-negative bacteria that are often in our gut, right? And as you said, it becomes stimulatory, right? When it breaches the gut barrier, and that's called intestinal permeability in the medical literature, and it's sometimes called leaky gut more colloquially, right? But what's interesting is that researchers have been creating rodent models of depression, believe it or not, there's such a thing. And the way that they create it is by injecting these animals with lipopolysaccharide, right? And they develop an inflammatory response and they begin behaving like depressed animals. And this was one of the sort of key pieces of research that helped us to understand that the gut might have something to do with behavior, right? Because I think it's pretty intuitive to many of us that our brain has something to do with controlling our gut, right? Like we've all been nervous and lost our appetite, or
we've all been around our family at the end of a big Christmas dinner and seen everyone just kind of the energy of the room just drop as well.
Yeah.
As another exactly. one. Yep.
Exactly. So what's less intuitive is, you know, sort of signaling in the other direction. You know, how does the gut tell the brain what's going on, and why could that ever be problematic? And so what we're learning is that at least one of the major avenues is called the vagus nerve, which is a critical cranial nerve that actually connects the gut and the brain, and that seems to play a major role in communicating what's going on in the gut. Okay, so again, inflammatory activity, immune stimulation in the gut lining, whether it's, you know, sort of changes in the ecology of the gut or what we call dysbiosis, then that message is, sort of trafficked up to the brain from the gut. And so this is how we've sort of made the connection between the gut, the immune system, and the inflammatory response. And it's called in the literature psychoneuroimmunology. And it's really devastating all of these false boundaries that we thought used to exist between all of these different organ systems. And it's very poetic because it just brings us back to where all ancient forms of medicine have been the whole time, right? Like Chinese medicine or Ayurveda have been talking about the gut as the seat of health for literally centuries, if not thousands of years. So we're just catching up.
They did do pretty well, the old traditional Chinese doctors. Now, a lot of what happens in someone's gut is dictated to them around birth and how the health of their mother was. Do you want to talk really briefly about how we get started with gut health?
Yes. So this is one of my, most, I think it's one of the most important topics because there's a lot of misunderstanding out there. A lot of it is perpetuated by this idea that birth is something to be medicalized, right? So there's no more patriarchal arm of medicine than obstetrics. And it is one of the least evidence-based practices. In fact, I've quoted literature that says that only 30% of modern obstetrical practice in America has any evidence base to support it. It's pretty crazy. So we have a problem here, right? Because we are learning that those 9 months in utero and about the first 2 years, but specifically the first 6 months postpartum or infancy, set the stage for your entire adult life in terms of your health. And the in utero part is called the fetal origins of adult disease. And we began to appreciate this once we learned about epigenetics, right? Once we finished the Human Genome Project, which was a major buzzkill because basically we learned just about nothing about how to intervene in terms of the modern illnesses. And we had to look for how and why we were as complex as we are, more than an earthworm, frankly. So epigenetics brought us back into the realm of antenatal health. And we began to understand that what the mom eats, what the mom thinks, you know, what kinds of chemicals the mom is exposed to while she's pregnant are pretty major. And it puts a lot of pressure on women, obviously, but it is a big deal. So that pressure on some level should be there, frankly. It's quite an endeavor to embark upon motherhood. And in America, we sort of treat it the way I did when I, you know, had my first, you know, child, which is like, all right, I'm going to stop my birth control now and I'll see if I can just continue my life exactly as it is and just happen to be pregnant. You know, that's not a consciousness we should be engaging anymore if we expect to have healthy offspring anyway. So what we've learned is that, a lot of microbial passage happens from mom to fetus during pregnancy, right? From even weird places like the mom's mouth, we're finding bacteria in the placenta that actually reflect the mom's oral microbiome, but notably her gut. You know, so bacteria from her gut actually translocate to the fetus and are found in the amniotic fluid, even in, you know, the feces of the baby when they're born, reflect the mom's sort of ecology. And then of course, breastfeeding is tailor-made to continue to transmit those microbes to the baby, the specific ones that complement all of the in utero development that already occurred. So this is exactly what, you know, we have relied on for robust immunity and development and neurodevelopment for the better part of humanity. And believe it or not, I just read a paper out of the American Academy of Pediatrics. This is the official mouthpiece for pediatrics in America, saying that we really shouldn't be calling breastfeeding natural, quote unquote, because it conflates it with other dangerous practices that are also considered natural, like home birth. And this is sort of where we're at. It's almost like a comical, like you'd think that was from like The Onion or some like, you know, sort of like parody piece, but it's not. This is really what's going on in America today. We have lost so much touch with what it means to be human, you know? It's like we think of ourselves like machines to be managed, and that thinking has not gotten us very far.
So we're given our microbiome by our parents then. And on that note, I think it may have been William Davis who did the study, or I'm thinking more likely he published it on his blog or something. But he found a study where scientists got a bunch of rodents and they split them up basically into two groups. I think there was like the outgoing rodents who wanted to play and run around on their little wheel and stuff. And then there were the ones who wanted to sit by themselves. And by doing a swap of their microbiomes, he was able to turn the introverted rodents into extroverted and vice versa. He was able to take the personality of these rats with... Did he do the study or was that on his blog? I can't remember.
I don't think he did, but I could be be wrong if he replicated it. But yeah, that was some of the first research that began to illuminate this notion that what we call personality actually could be encoded in our biology, right? And, you know, they've even taken the fecal microbiota of a human depressed patients and put it into unsuspecting rodents and changed their behavior, changed the rodent behavior, like even cross species. It's pretty wild and it's quite meaningful. They've done the same actually with research into obesity, you know, taking fecal transplants from obese mice to thin ones and making them fat. So the microbiome is up to just about everything, literally from hormone modulation to blood sugar balance, to of course control of behavior and cognition. There's not much that isn't touched by the microbiome. So it's really dominating the literature right now.
So on that note, when you say that depression is epigenetic, not genetic, those two sound like largely the same thing. For someone like me who has a family history of depression, what are you saying? Am I just completely hosed or is it changeable?
Oh my
or
God.
What's the story?
I'm saying the opposite, right? So the power and the beauty and the gift in the concept of epigenetics is that you are given back control, right? So no longer are you born into your destiny where you just have to suck up the fact that you've been dealt a bad hand and cozy up with the pharmaceutical industry for your entire life to help you just be you? That story is over. Now, in my opinion, there is not a single exception to the epigenetic rule. You can literally change the expression of every gene in your body with the information that you expose it to. And there is none more powerful than nutrition. I had the gift of being mentored by Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez here in New York City before he passed last summer. And I watched him treat, you know, BRCA positive breast cancer patients who were terminal, right? Like basically told to go home and die, and alive 30 years later under his care because of his nutritional methodology, right? So food is one of the most powerful ways we have to speak to our genes. And, you know, as I've said, you can either like whisper them a love poem or you can scream at them, you know, like a banshee. So we have this choice every single day. So what we eat, what we breathe, what we think, what we drink all becomes highly relevant.
Now, I think most people are pretty aware of the fact that, you know, eating really, really badly is predictably going to change the way you feel about yourself and many different, you know, kind of KPIs of health. And in your word, instead of saying screaming like a banshee, you actually said gut bomb, which is something I love. What's a gut bomb?
So I'm just trying to, you know, to highlight the point that every time you take a bite, you're sort of saying yes or saying no to your body, right? And there are some, like, while I'm very interested in a pretty radical commitment to a different way of living. I understand that some people need bite-sized doses, no pun intended, right? So they might want to know, you know, like, what are the three top foods that I just need to totally steer clear of for a month if I want to see some changes? And so I think of them as being most notably, and I think best researched, are wheat, so gluten, dairy, primarily cow dairy, and sugar, because all of those have evidence in the realm of psychiatry, but specifically in the realm of intestinal inflammation. And actually, even the metabolites from wheat and dairy can have brain-based effects, right? We're beginning to understand why they're so addictive, right? People get pretty upset with me when I bring up these categories, right? These are some of the most addictive foods you can possibly eat. I know firsthand because I gave them up 7.5 years ago, and it was like I might as well have been in rehab for how difficult it was. So, you know, we have to appreciate that not only do they wreak havoc at the gut level, but of course, then they also deeply influence your brain.
Mm. Now, these things, gluten, dairy, there are other gut bombs that you talk about in your book, like genetically modified organisms, fake sugar, so you said like the equals and splendors of the world,
yeah,
antibiotics, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, proton pump inhibitors, or antacids as we would call them down here, and also antidepressants. Do you think that there'll ever be a point where the people who've been saying, this is healthy, you should do this, it's going to make you feel better, even though the research is out there saying that's not true and it's actually having the opposite effect, will ever have like an Aaron Brockovich kind of accountability moment where they have to say, look, we really should have known that this was bad for people and we sold it even though we shouldn't have? Do you think we'll ever get to that point?
You know, I'm not holding my breath for it because there are always probably going to be people who need to believe that conventional medicine is onto something meaningful, right? They need to believe that there is such a thing as a quick fix, there is such a thing as a magic pill, that we can trust our doctors, that we can trust our government, and that, you know, it's just a matter of being a good patient. Actually, being a good patient can get you in a lot of trouble these days. So I have to believe that there's still more to the story in terms of the longevity of the pharmaceutical model. And there's so much invested in protecting that guild, right? But I also feel pretty excited about creating something really appealing and alluring and powerful, totally independent of the existing model, right? So that is, I'm not interested in, I used to be, but I've really let it go. I'm not interested in warring against, you know, the man. I'm not interested in convincing anyone. I'm not going on Fox News, obviously, you know, to debate. It's just not what I'm here for. I'm here to show people that this exists because sometimes you just need to know it does and you feel that yes inside and then you can find your tribe. You know, we're here waiting and we're loving it. It's awesome to be on this side of the conversation. So I think there's really sort of like a, you know, choose your story. And I think eventually the pharmaceutical model will probably atrophy just because there'll be more and more people who are not helped by it or who are injured by it and who come over to this camp, you know, voluntarily without any competitor propaganda. So I don't know. I don't know that it's going to be a big expose. There have been so many medications that have been recalled, you know, from Vioxx killing tens of thousands of people that there's never much fanfare about it. It's sort of just like considered, you know, the cost of doing business. You know, when cigarettes were finally exposed for their potential to harm, you know, it was like, oh, okay, well, let's put some labels on it and tell people that they might be killing themselves if they do what their doctor had recommended a couple of years before, which is literally to smoke cigarettes. I mean, they're literally ads from, you know, the 50s or whatever it is of doctors recommending cigarettes. You know, we've made so many colossally embarrassing mistakes in the history of medicine that to think that we are not amidst more of those mistakes is really a naivete that could get you in a lot of trouble.
Mm, absolutely. Now, presumably most people who are listening to this won't all have depression. So if you are listening to this and you do have depression, thank you so much for joining us, and I really appreciate that. But there will be people listening to this who know someone who has depression and maybe won't go and take the action steps to listen to a podcast like this or go and read a book like yours. So if someone's listening to this podcast and they go and get your book and they know someone who's struggling with this issue, how do they bring this topic up in conversation?
Well, funny you should bring that up, because I've really been focused on that. And I actually just like hours ago launched a webpage specifically for that purpose, because this has been coming up a lot. There's been a lot of grassroots support for this book, and people are asking exactly that question. So I created a website, that's on my website, just a page that talks about, like, you know, here's a one-page fact sheet you could give someone that you love who's depressed. Here's a one-page fact sheet you could look at if you're thinking about medication. I included like a video from me and then an ebook, like a small book that I put together. It's almost like a summary of all this. So, you know, the idea is that it's going to be very challenging to convince someone if they're already on the path to medication that they should, you know, take a left turn and try this whole protocol. What might convince them is the data around really the Russian roulette that taking a medication like an antidepressant can entail. And that's what really freaked me out when I began to look into the research of British psychiatrist David Healy, who basically exposed, again, a lot of the manipulated and unpublished literature suggesting that these medications can cause suicide and homicide within days of the first dose. And you don't know if you're going to be that person. There is literally a study I quote in some of my blogs that is of normal people murdering their children under the influence of an antidepressant that they are then withdrawn from, and they basically snap out of it and say, like, who did that, right? And we're finding that these people all have, and it's very preliminary science, but that these people all have a genetic variant in their liver that actually, you know, makes it so that they metabolize medication differently, and they basically become impulsive and violent. If you go onto a page called SSRIstories.org, you'll find that all of the media making cases at least in the States, but even that German pilot who took the plane down recently, have been in patients who were recently started on an antidepressant or recently taken off one. So the coming on and coming off can be extremely triggering for these patients. And, you know, these are cases of infanticide, mass murder, violence, and homicide. That's pretty concerning, I would say. So we're not talking about like, oh, why not try it? You know, my doctor says it could help. We're talking about what could literally be a life-ending decision. So this is, it's pretty serious stuff, unfortunately. It's like, I know this is like ends up being a depressing conversation in and of itself, but I'm very interested in informed consent. I want people to have the full picture, the full story, before they make a decision about their healthcare. And that's all that matters. Because then once they know, hey, listen, to each his own, right? And it's not for any of us to decide what somebody else should do with their health, but they should have all of the information first. And no one should resist getting data and facts.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I'm a victim of non-informed consent.
Yes.
So when I was younger, I used to get these crippling migraines 2 times a week usually, and they were so painful I would lose my vision, and I would also be physically ill like all night, and I also had depression at the same time. And there was one point I remember where I went to go and get my migraine medication, but it may have been my antidepressant medication, like the script redone by the doctor that I was seeing, and he wasn't there, so I saw someone else, and I said, can I get some more of this? And she looked at my chart and she said, I can't give you that, that potentially could kill you. So I was taking Zoloft, which is an SSRI, and I was also taking a migraine medication that looks like serotonin as well. So I was taking this fake serotonin. This is my extremely amateur understanding of it. And the doctor looked at me and she said, if I prescribe that to you, that could kill you. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, the normal doctor's been giving me that for like 6 or 7 years. So we really have lost like informed consent. And that's a really big issue.
That's a bold example, because that's even, you know, something that all you have to do as a doctor is know the product insert to be able to warn about that. The medication interactions is a huge problem. I mean, you know, properly prescribed prescriptions is one of the leading causes of death in this country, right? Those are properly prescribed. So imagine, you know, cases like yours. We are really, really sort of like dancing with the devil when it comes to these products. And it's because our bodies were not designed to interface with these totally foreign chemicals that seek to, you know, beat us into submission. We have to learn that the only way we're going to win is if we work with our bodies and we support them, you know, because they know a lot better how to fix themselves than we do. We just make mistakes all over the place. And we're going to continue to do that because science is highly imperfect, right? It's a process. So, you know, that's why using things like probiotics that we used to think bacteria was universally dangerous. And now we understand that we can actually even use probiotics as like cleaners in a hospital, as opposed to bleach, for example. We're slowly, slowly getting the message that cooperating, you know, with our bodies and our ecology is really the only way we're going to get out of this mess of chronic disease that we're steeped in.
Mm. Now, the last point I want to talk about before I let you go, Dr. Brogan, is your confidence as a practitioner. So in your book, and I loved this, you said, quote, "Your patients work hard on what you give them at a time when they feel like they can't even lift a finger. When the prospect of walking to the drugstore with a slip of paper twinkles like the North Star in their dark sky. They follow my lead because they feel inspired by my conviction and hope in this new model." So your confidence and passion, where does that come from within you to do what you do, like write this book and get yourself blacklisted on, you know, TV and all that kind of stuff? And where can people find that in themselves?
I love that question. You know, it's an interesting thing because everyone has that, like, reservoir of energy just sort of sitting in there at all times. You know, I use the example, if you had the flu, right, and you felt like you were going to die, and I walked in the room, like burst in the room, and I'm like, oh my God, I just found out you won the lottery, right? Like, it's like $40 million. You would probably feel pretty good for at least a couple of hours and forget that you had the flu. You wouldn't even care, right? So that reserve of energy is there. It's in there all the time in all of us. And so often when I meet with a patient and I discuss with them, listen, I put my own chronic autoimmune disease into remission with exactly what I'm telling you about. I have saved countless patients at this point from a destiny that they thought was the only available path of prescription medication. I have taken patients off of their medication so that they can literally transform their consciousness and start a new chapter of their entire existence, let alone just get their symptoms gone. This is all possible for you. Then I can sort of almost like see that little flicker and it takes over. You know, some of my sickest patients are my most motivated, most compliant, you know, patients with the most robust outcomes. And it doesn't make sense according to our understanding of, you know, the dependent, debilitated patient. So I have to believe that there's hope in each of us still for like a different story. And this feels so true to me that I understand it to be like the reason I'm here on this planet. And I won't stop spreading, you know, the knowledge about it as, you know, as far and wide as I can, because I believe it's why I'm here. And, you know, listen, we all have our contribution to make. I believe every single person, you know, comes into that alignment if they just, I don't know, get out of their own way, right? And they begin to trust a process. And part of that, at least for me, was beginning to trust my body and what it was here to tell me, you know, about my own lifestyle, eating McDonald's and drinking Red Bull for 30 years. So I, you know, I got to a point where I needed to be reminded that if I want to have an incredible experience on this planet, that I need to honor, you know, honor my body first.
Well, I'm personally hugely appreciative of what you've been doing. And I think you're an excellent researcher and a really good leader for young pups like myself. And I hope one day I'll be able to quote something out of your book and maybe someone will challenge me and say, well, where did you hear that? And I'll say, Kelly Brogan said that. And I think one day that'll really mean something. In fact, it already means a lot to me now to have you on this show sharing all your wisdom and all your research. So for everyone out there who's listening, your book is called A Mind of Your Own. Where can people find you on the internet if they're looking for more information?
So thank you for that, first of all. My website is just kellybroganmd.com, and you'll see that page that I was talking about sharing this information with people that you love and care about. And you can actually even read the first chapter if you want for free. See if it's for you.
And it is a very readable book. I know I said it was 1,100 pages on my iPad. Most of that was resources, and I still reckon I would have been able to read this book 9 years ago, back when I was massively depressed and didn't know anything about health. So everyone out listening, go and grab a copy of that. Kelly Brogan, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Total pleasure. Thank you.
Authentic Wellness Radio.